Well, today, we're going to start the book of Matthew. I'm going to call the series Mostly Matthew, because we're going to do most of the book of Matthew, and we're not only going to do the book of Matthew, we're going to mostly do Matthew, right? And I was looking at what we mostly had to cover when we mostly did Matthew, I decided we better start really close to the beginning, but not right at the beginning. I'm not going to go through all the stuff in the genealogy. In fact, for the genealogy, I'm only going to give you one verse of genealogy. All right? That one verse will be sufficient. We're going to talk this morning about the king representative. Those that have heard me teach for a long period of time are familiar with this language. If you've not heard me teach on this subject, this is like, whoa, king representative. I've never heard that one before. And I would say, you're right. You've never heard it that way before. Although you've heard the theology before. I'm just putting it into kingdom terminology, and I'm going to show you how cool it is when you understand the Old Testament, all right? And you can draw on the Old Testament and bring the kingdom ideas into the New Testament and see the fullness of what's going on there. Every one of the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, each one of these present a unique picture of Jesus. The book of Matthew presents information about Jesus being the king of the kingdom of God. And that's why I like it so much. It just goes right down the teaching, beginning to end, what I want to present to you. In order to present to you information of the king representative, I have to give you a brief review of the covenants. These covenants are Adamic, the covenant God made with Adam. These are the major covenants in the Bible. This is not the same thing as covenant theology. It's a little different here. Talking about the Noahic covenant, this is the covenant God made with Noah. That was, I will never flood the earth again. Please don't kill one another. The short version of it. Number three, the Abrahamic covenant. I covered this a couple of months ago fairly in depth when I was speaking about faith. Fourth, the Mosaic covenant, which we call the Old Covenant, the Old Testament part of our Bibles. Primarily or originally, we're talking about the Ten Commandments here, but not only the Ten Commandments. When we talk about the Mosaic covenant, it's the whole package. Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, really all the kinds of things that are in there. There's a lot of parts to it. So the law initially was the Ten Commandments, the Decalogue, and that was the covenant there. But there's more to it. It grew to include dietary regulations, the religious things, the ceremonies. We call that the cultic things. It's not cult, but it's the cultic part, to use the right terminology that you'll understand. It included their government, their feasts, their land issues. Everything got heaped into the Mosaic covenant, but it started with the Ten Commandments. Now, in all of these covenants that I've mentioned so far, there's a common idea that you, well, maybe not with the Adamic one so much, but there's this issue of the individual has to choose to participate in the covenant. I mean, if you wanted to be, you know, if you were a child of Abraham, you could choose whether or not to be in the covenant or not. If you were part of Israel, part of the nation, you could be cut off from your people. That language is all along. Why? Because you chose not to be part of the covenant anymore. Then you get to the Davidic covenant. I'm going to talk about that this morning, the covenant God makes with David, and then the new covenant of Jesus Christ. The two I want to focus on as we go into this thinking process of the Abrahamic covenant and the Davidic covenant. Don't worry, this will all come together at the end of this very long, complicated sermon. Okay? The Abrahamic covenant. There's this three parts to it that I want you to remember. This is mostly like a review thing. The first part, Genesis 12, 1-3, I will bless you, God said. Come out of your people, I will bless you, I will make you a blessing to all people. That was the first part of it. The second part was the promise of descendants and the promise of righteousness. This is the two parts where God calls Abraham out into the night and says, look up at the stars, so shall your offspring be, so shall your descendants be. And Abraham believed God and it was credited to him as righteousness. But the fullness of the Abrahamic covenant doesn't come together until you get to this last part here, Genesis 17, 1-22. And the sign of the covenant, circumcision, is given, and the child of the promise is Isaac. And he's given here as well. All of these things are important and form the Abrahamic covenant. It starts with the promise of blessing, but the fullness of the idea comes piece by piece through the life of Abraham. So all the descendants of Isaac are part of the covenant. But they must keep the sign of the covenant, circumcision, or else they will no longer be part of the covenant. Okay? So there's a covenant part that's unconditional and a part that's conditional. In these covenants, remember that. There's the unconditional part where God promises something, I will bless you. And the conditional part where you must do something. You must exercise some kind of faith that shows that you care about this covenant. And for the descendants of Abraham, it was the sign of circumcision. That showed that they participated in the covenant. That they wanted to continue being part of it. And that's the important thing there. In the Mosaic covenant, the people chose whether they wanted to continue living under the covenant or they wanted to drift away and go be somebody else. And they had that freedom. Now we get to this idea of the transition of responsibility in the Old Testament. And I want to talk about the people of Israel. They've come out of Egypt, right? They are in the desert for 40 years. And now they are moving into the land. They've taken the southern trip around the land. They're at the Jordan River. They're going to cross the Jordan. And they go in there under Joshua. And they fight the Battle of Jericho. And they have a smashing victory, right? Then after this victory, they go on to fight a little town, a little battle. The Battle of Ai. And one person had sinned there and has taken something he shouldn't have. They were told to give everything to the Lord at the Battle of Joshua, and Achan had stolen some stuff. And then they lost this battle, this trivial little battle. And so what's the concept here? The concept here is under Joshua, if one person sinned, it affected the whole community. How'd you like that? How'd you like if God made all of us sick if one of you sinned? Can you imagine that? Well, that's what they did to Achan. And they found out who he was and they killed him. So you have this picture of the whole community under Moses and then again under Joshua. The whole community rose together or fell together. But it doesn't stay that way, fortunately. The whole community at this point is responsible for the sin of one man. But after they get into the land, you have this period of the judges. You know the book of Judges? You know, who are some of the judges? Samson, yeah, you got to get him right. He's pretty famous. Anybody think of another judge? Deborah, yeah? Samuel. Samuel's really going to be the last judge. He's an important one. But anyway, you get into this period of the judges, and there's this transition. What you have to keep in mind are the book of Judges is not a chronological story. If you try to read it chronologically, you're going to get baffled by it, and it's going to seem like it's hundreds and hundreds of years. It's not. It's a couple hundred years tops. It's a really short period of time in their history. The reason it looks like so long is you have all these judges, but they're working in different parts of the land. So you have one of the judges, Samson. He's from the tribe of Dan. What you have going on here is these judges are regional, so they're effective in different parts. And God gives blessing to that area. I mean, they go through this time where God is punishing the people collectively, but he raises up an individual faithful person to do what? To deliver the people. So you get this beginning picture where an individual comes along and that individual faith of one person, like Gideon, is enough to transform the community and bring deliverance, God's deliverance. Very, very significant thing. So one person's sin is no longer a problem. It's now one man's faith that leads to blessing, that leads to victory over the enemies. So the nation at this point is only loosely connected. And they're busy fighting regional battles against different people. And they're at times fighting against one another in civil war. And so the behavior of the people is taken as blessing and cursing as a national event, but also a regional event. And then the last judge, Samuel, anoints the first king. All right? And now we see another transition forming. It begins to form under Saul, who's attempting to bring the entire nation together, to unify them. And he's doing a great job of it, except for there's one particular concept he has trouble with. He isn't quite sure who the king of Israel is. Sometimes he's under the impression that he's the king. And he's not the king. The king of Israel was God. And that's where he went wrong. When you watch this transition period, you have the idea of the judges flowing over into the idea of the kings. You have battles like Jonathan going out and fighting the Philistines. You know, him and his armor bearer take on everybody. You have David going out and fighting Goliath, and a huge victory comes. It's forming. This concept is forming for David. And then when you get to David, you see something very special happen in his lifetime. And that is the Davidic covenant. The Davidic covenant comes along. This is found in 2 Samuel 7, 1-16. I'm not going to read the whole thing for you. But initially, the idea is this. Here's David. He's got peace in the land. Everything's going pretty well. He's set up in Jerusalem. He's built himself a nice cedar house. And he says, I'm living in a nice cedar house, and God is living in a tent. There's something wrong with this picture. So he calls in the prophet Nathan. He said, Nathan, I want to build a temple for God. I want to build a house for God. And Nathan says, go for it, David. Sounds great to me. Later that night, God shows up to Nathan and says, Nathan, you're a little hasty here. Here's what I want you to go and tell David. Then Nathan returns the next day to David, and he says, David, I have a word from the Lord. He says, David, I've lived in tents for all these years, for 100 years. No one has ever offered to build me a house except for you. But I'll tell you, I'll make you a deal. Since you've offered to build me a house, I'm going to build you a house, an everlasting house. And of course, he's talking about the house of David, his line. Now, there were a few conditions on this thing. There was the unconditional part of the covenant, God saying, you will always have a son to sit before me on the throne. But then there was the conditional part of the covenant that said, that son of yours who sits in the throne has to meet a few qualifications. All right? Namely, and one of the most important parts, is he must be like you. In other words, get this now. David, the son who will qualify to sit on your throne, must have the same value system as you do. That's what God said to him. And if he doesn't share your value system, David, I will remove him from the throne. This is an important concept. There's the conditional part that each son of David had to play in it. They had to exercise faith like their father, David. So that's one part of the covenant. And there's this interesting shift that happens now. The shift that happens during the reign of David is that the king becomes the representative of all the people before God. Do you remember that when I talked to you about Melchizedek and how important Melchizedek was to David? Melchizedek was crucially important to David. Why? He was a priest, he was a king, and he lived in Jerusalem. And so when David gets this covenant promise from God, he starts forming these psalms about the coming messianic king. The Lord said to my Lord, right? These ones that are quoted in the New Testament. And they're psalms about he will be a priest forever in the order of Melchizedek. So the one who fulfills the covenant of David, the promised king, will be the Messiah. But this idea that the king becomes a representative of the people is crucial. Because the priest had the priestly line was of Levi. The Judah was not given a priesthood. And yet when you get to the book of Hebrews, you'll see that all elaborated out. It begins here. David, although he's not truly a priest, gets to become the representative of the people. And some of you are saying, that is the biggest story I've ever heard, because that's not anywhere in the Bible. Let me show you how this works. One day, David decided he would have a census in the land. He said, I'm going to see how many warriors I can muster if I ever need them. And God said, don't do this thing. And David went ahead and did it anyway. And as a result of one man's sin, what did God do? Punished the whole nation. He said, you know those numbers you calculated, David? I'm going to throw them off. I'm going to kill your people. I'm going to kill your people. So that all those numbers you just took don't work anymore. You may as well throw them away because they're not going to be valid anymore. I'm going to give you an option, though, of how your people are going to die. Gee, thanks. See, David becomes the representative of the people before God. And as you go through the rest of the Old Testament, under the kings, under the line of David, in particular in Judah, you see this transition from warrior to king. The main question never changed is who is the true king? And the important thing here is David understood who the true king was. The true king of Israel was still God. He was the under-shepherd of the people. And that was an important thing he had to learn and know. This was the question in the wilderness. It was the question during the conquest of Canaan, under the judges and Samuel, and under Saul and David. Who is the king? This is what David understood and Saul rejected. God wanted his people to be like David. Was David perfect? Absolutely not. He wanted his people to be like David. Why? Because David knew who the king was. And David, although he failed, he wanted to please God and he wanted to know God. So we see this idea that God says about David, no one has a heart like David. Why? Because David had a heart after God. What does it mean to have a heart after God? To pursue his value system. The reason God wanted more people like David is David understood, although David failed, and we all fail, David understood that he had to become like God in his own heart. So we get into the historical books, Samuel, Kings. Samuel's about the establishment of the kingdom. And the kings talk about the downfall of the kingdom. The book of Kings talk about the downfall of the kingdom of Israel. What's important to see there, it's all downhill from Solomon. I mean, it's all downhill, almost from David, but especially from Solomon. And the idea that the king of is the representative of the people is confirmed in all these stories. How is that done? Well, every time a king is spoken about in the book of Kings, there's always an evaluation given about them, right? They were either good or evil. If there were any king of Israel, they were always evil. 100% of the time, evil. It doesn't matter how good they were still evil. Because they were only measured by one criteria in the north. And that criteria was, did they serve Yahweh or not? See, in the north, you have to remember, they created their rival religion to keep people in the 10 tribes in the north, to keep them from going down to Jerusalem to worship Yahweh. That's why it didn't matter how good a guy they had up there, he was still a failure in the eyes of God because he turned them to a different worship, a different God, or a different way of worshiping God in some cases. In Judah, if you read through especially the books of Chronicles, you see a different standard. Every single one of the kings is measured in a different way. What is the standard used to measure the kings of Judah? How much they were like their father David. Every time. They either were like their father David or they weren't. They either had their father's value system or they didn't. All the way through, again and again and again. And if you read the stories, if the people obeyed God, they were blessed. And if they didn't obey God, they were cursed. All the way through, beginning with David. So as goes the king, there goes the kingdom. Partially because of the value system should flow down from the top, but also because of the idea of the king becoming a representative. God wanted people to adopt the value system of David. Then comes one of David's children named Manasseh. Manasseh is the absolute epitome of evil when it comes to being a king. I'm going to read this section, portions of it. This is from 2 Kings 21, 10 to 15, bits of it. The Lord said to his servants, the prophets, because Manasseh, king of Judah, has committed these abominations and have done these things, more evil than all the people who lived in the land before us, I am bringing on Jerusalem and Judah such disaster that the ears of everyone who hears of it will tingle when they hear it. I'm going to stretch over Jerusalem the measuring line, listen, of Samaria and the plumb line of the house of Ahab. What is he saying? For the sins of Samaria, which was the capital of the north, and Ahab, who was the leader up there, Jezebel's husband, for them I destroyed their kingdom. I wiped them out. And guess what? I'm going to use that same measuring line now against Jerusalem because of Manasseh. So God says to them, I'm going to wipe Jerusalem out like a dish and flip it upside down. And God says, I will forsake the remnant of my heritage and give them into the hand of their enemies. Now, in other words, you are all doomed. Okay, I just paraphrase the verses down to it. You are all doomed. Now, Manasseh lived a long period of time. And you know, at the end of his life, he was hauled away into captivity and he repented. He repented. And he lived a long time. And he had a grandson named Josiah. So we read about him a couple chapters later, 2 Kings 23 to 27. And listen to the description. This is like the greatest king that ever lived, okay? Before him, there was no king like him who turned to the Lord with all his heart and with all his soul and with all his might, according to the law of Moses, nor did any arise after him. And he's better than everybody before him and better than anybody after him. Wow. That's credentials, right? Can you imagine writing that on your business card? I'm the king. No one's been better and nobody will ever be better than me. Wow. God's response to that is, you're still all doomed. Let me read the rest of the verse. Still, the Lord did not turn from the burning of his great wrath by which his anger was kindled against Judah because of all the provocations with which Manasseh had provoked him. And the Lord said, I will remove Judah out of my sight as I have removed Israel, and I will cast off this city as I have chosen, Jerusalem, and the house of which I said, my name shall be there. The promise that God made to Manasseh as the representative of the people still stood, even after Manasseh's repentance and after Josiah comes along. It's very interesting here to understand. Manasseh's sin brought the whole destruction of the whole nation permanent. The point of the story is, be careful who your king representative is. That's the point of the story. You get the wrong king representative, I don't care if you're Daniel, you're going to Babylon. So let's look at this idea of conditional and unconditional. I want to review these covenants of David and Abraham now. The idea of conditional and unconditional. Both of the covenants have a conditional part and an unconditional part. The unconditional part comes because of the originator of the promise. If God promises to do something, he's going to do it. That's just the way he operates. God makes a covenant with Abraham and with David. And part of the covenant comes because of who Abraham is and David is. God doesn't make the covenants with Abraham and David just randomly. He picks these guys out for a purpose because of who they are, because of their faith in him. So the conditional part, because both of these promises apply, or the covenants apply, not only to the one person God makes it with, but their ongoing progeny. And God says, because of that, I'm making this unconditional part of blessing, but there's still going to be a conditional part tied to the individual child that you have. They'll still have to choose to be part of this covenant that I make. So the conditional part comes to the descendants, those who participate in the covenant after the fact. They're influenced by and they inherit the blessing of the covenant, but they still must exercise personal faith to remain part of the covenant community and covenant blessing. So what is a covenant? Well, it's a promise. That's all it is. It's just promise. You read about a covenant, it's just a promise. It's just different language. So we have in our Bibles the Old Testament and the New Testament. The word testament there is really too bad. We're stuck with that because it's really poor language for us to understand. We don't think of that. We think of the last will and testament now. So we're kind of stuck using a word we don't really understand in the context. The language there is Old Covenant and New Covenant. The Old Covenant and the New Covenant. You know, when Jesus says, I give to you a new covenant in my blood, well, that's what the real titles of the book should be. Or, if you want, the idea of promise in there, the Old Promise and the New Promise. Because what is a covenant? A covenant is a promise between two people or two groups of people in which there's obligations on both parts to do something. So, if I make a covenant promise with Todd, so we will make a promise to each other. I will bless your children and you will bless my children. And if one of us hurts the other's children, then there will be consequences, right? And we'll write out those consequences, right? That would be a nature of a covenant. And you see people in the Old Testament entering these covenants. And really the language there is they cut a covenant. So what that meant is you took an animal and you cut it in half, and then the participants of the covenant would walk between the pieces, and they say, if we break the covenant, may we become like the pieces of this animal that we just cut up. And then we ate the animal and had a good time. All right, you didn't want to break the covenant, because you died if you did it in some cases, if that's what the consequence. So it was a binding legal agreement. You didn't just walk away from. It was a big deal. When God makes these covenants, he's making a promise that he intends to keep. So the conditional part of the covenant is the individual decides whether or not he wants to be part of it. The unconditional, God will do what he says. The conditional part, the faith of the individual. Why is faith so important? We've covered faith before. The idea, the concept of faith here. Well, you have to believe that God's going to keep his promise, right? What is faith? Faith is believing the promises of God. Faith is believing that God will keep his covenant promises. If you lose faith in the covenant promises of God, you lose faith in his word and him, and everything else just comes down like a house of cards. It's all over. Faith has to believe to enter into the covenant. And then faith continues in the covenant by keeping the conditions of the covenant. There's something you have to do to be part of that covenant. With Abraham, what was the condition of the covenant? The people had to keep circumcision. With David, what was the condition of the covenant? Each one of the children of David had to adopt the value system of his father, or else they would be removed from the throne. So then we come to the New Testament, and Jesus fulfills two promises. Two promises God makes are fulfilled by Jesus. The first is the one to Abraham, and the second is the one to David. Jesus comes to fulfill the promise to be a blessing to all people, and he comes to fulfill the promise there will be a king, a son, who sits on your throne forever. And these two come perfectly into balance here, because Jesus most perfectly has his father's value system. And I'm not talking about the value system of David here, the value system of God in heaven. What happens here? Matthew 1:1, the book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. When Matthew starts out the gospel, he starts it with this one verse. And I'm going to ignore the rest of the genealogy and the birth story of Jesus. We're going to skip a lot of that. And I want you to see this one verse. The book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David and the son of Abraham. Right from the very first verse, Matthew wants you to understand, Jesus comes to fulfill two covenants, the covenant with David and the covenant with Abraham. Those are the only covenants that really matter to us. Jesus comes under the new covenant here. He comes as the new king. The king of David, but the king of the kingdom of God. He comes as the new representative of the people in his kingdom before God. This is the cool part. So what you see developing as David being the priest king, and this theology is really built up in the book of Hebrews, the king representative. Jesus becomes your king representative. He's the representative before God of everybody in his kingdom. So when he dies on the cross, he represents you. But his righteousness before God represents you as well. Everything he does, he represents you. God no longer measures you by you. He measures everything about you by your king representative. That's really cool. So you've heard this theology, maybe as headship theology or some way in which he is your head, your leader. I'm just using the language that's developed under kingdom ideas in the Old Testament and the New Testament. Jesus, as your king representative, is the only one God looks at for everybody in his kingdom. However, to receive the benefits of Jesus as your king, you must be in his kingdom. Jesus only represents those in his kingdom. This is a crucial thing to understand. That's why his death on the cross can be sufficient for all, or universal if you want. Wouldn't matter. He only represents those in his kingdom. And if you don't want to be in his kingdom, he's not your king. And he doesn't represent you before God. Guess who gets to represent you before God? You do. And God expects you to adopt the king's value system. Just as God expected all the sons of David to adopt the value system of their father to continue in the covenant, when we come into the kingdom, God expects us to adopt the value system of our king. When we fail to adopt the value system, fortunately, we have a king representative. You see, now what I've just given you is incredibly intense, deep theology, and I hope it didn't feel like that, in a very simple format, in a two-word phrase that you shouldn't be able to forget. King representative. See, if I talk about headship theory, you're going to go, what does that mean? And I can give you all the theology, but I always talk about the king representative, Jesus being the king of the kingdom. He fulfills the promises of King David. When the king in the Old Testament sat on the throne, he became the representative of his people. He became a priest forever in the order of Melchizedek. This is all developed in the book of Hebrew. I've dumped all this theology into one connection. King representative. All your ideas of justification are tied up in king representative. All your ideas of God forgiving you, king representative. Pretty slick, huh? So the new covenant is a new promise made between God the Father and God the Son. You realize that? We enter into the new covenant as well, but the real promise in the new covenant is between the Father and the Son. Individuals come into the covenant by belief in that promise. So just as God made a promise to Abraham and individuals followed, God made a promise to David and individuals followed, God the Father makes a promise to God the Son, and we individuals can enter into that blessing as well. Faith, our faith in believing this promise and entering into the covenant, results in our righteousness and the reception of the benefits of having a righteous king. So God treats us no longer by what our works deserve, but according to the righteousness of the one who sits on David's throne. Jesus comes as the fulfillment of both the covenant to Abraham and the covenant to David, as well as the one of the new covenant. And he stands as the head of blessing for everyone in his kingdom. You get that? I thought, you need this foundation for what comes later. You need this foundation. That's theology that needs time to settle in and you need to think about and really understand and grasp.